Leaders are all around us and in every area of our lives. They motivate. They risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In this special episode of the Central Texas Leadership Series, we've invited voices from NPR programs that have been companions to KWBU listeners. Former KWBU reporter Becky Fogle of the Texas Standard hosts a conversation with Renee Montaigne, former Morning Edition host and NPR special correspondent. This interview was recorded October 26, 2017, in the KWBU studio.
Welcome to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I am Becky Fogle. I used to work here at KWBU, and I'm so excited to be back. Now I'm at the Texas Standard, but I'm back here today for a very special interview at the station. We have here Renee Montaigne, the longtime host of Morning Edition. And while you were a host of that program, you were a constant companion to Wacoans for years. And now, as a special correspondent for NPR, you continue to bring us in insightful, tough, and humane reporting. You sowed the seeds for all of that work when you first started with NPR in the 1980s. And when I was thinking about what I wanted to ask you today, Renee, first I want to say welcome before I start asking you questions. So welcome to KWBU.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Really a pleasure to have you here. And part of what I wanted to ask you, you've covered so many stories, and I kind of just wanted to really get a sense of how you approach your work. And so first I just wanted to ask you, do you remember the first story that you really wanted to tell?
Well, I can tell you, I remember the first story that I put on NPR, actually.
Oh, great.
As a freelancer. And I'm not so sure I should tell anybody about it, but actually I will tell you. I was freelancing, therefore I was casting about for things to do, and I wasn't living in California at the time. I was living in New York, but it was a good excuse to go back to California. I proposed a story about animals in the movies, like trained animals in the movies. And so I ended up, so my first story was, I went to a farm where they have animals and they're very careful with them and everything. And part of the story is what the animals sort of mean. Like if you see a giraffe, what in a way you're expected to have a feeling of glowing goodwill or something like that. And they ended up, I'll tell you this, they ended up, I didn't intend this, but I did the story. It was pretty straightforward, charming, I hope, but whatever, probably the feeling of a newbie. But then the NPR producer decided to put in it, which they didn't use those days, really, but that song, The Animals, it was a Paul Simon song? This stands for this and this stands for that. And I was like this, oh, my God, because it seemed like a joke, you know. And I wasn't horrified, but I was a little shocked. And after that, I moved on to more serious stories. So I thought I better be careful with the features, you know. Actually, that was very unusual. Nobody usually messed with your stories, even as a freelancer. I mean, one thing about radio, it's not like print where someone could cut out the heart of a piece of – it would be a silly thing to do. But if they did, or like print is pyramid style, where upside down pyramid, where you put the most important things at the top, get to it because everything after that is vulnerable to being cut. Yeah. Well, ours is more like beginning, middle, big moment, end. And the end is just as important as the beginning. So when I heard this, song show up, I was not only shocked, but I was all like, it kind of ruined my end. And so I was very, after that, I thought, I'm going to start doing more. No more features for me for a while. But again, nobody ever really messed with my stories. I have to say, I've had good luck. One thing about being a freelancer, even though I worked probably 6 days a week, it was good. It was a good trial run for Morning Edition because I never was off.
Yeah.
Because I needed to make money. I needed to pay the rent. It was pretty simple. The pay was super low, and I actually worked on other things like books on tape. I produced a few books on tape.
Wow.
I used to sell stories to the CBC, which I would do on Saturdays, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I mean, everything to feed my habit of being a freelancer for NPR. But the one thing it gave me was a certain amount of autonomy at an early stage where, you know, even though most every story I've ever gone out on, I've wanted to, there was always a sense that there was a kind of Renee story. I mean, I never had a real beat. I was never quite in a situation where I ran after fires. Although, yeah. Fires in Malibu or terrible fires that are front page news. That's another thing.
Yeah.
But I never had to chase after small stuff.
And obviously, Morning Edition, you had to cover pretty much anything that was in the news. But what kind of stories did you find yourself gravitating to? What kind of stories do you like to tell?
It's not so much a type of story, but everybody, Stevensky, David Green, everybody became known for and is known for sort of things they like among the staff. So they could always sort of tell, like, this would be something Renee's interested in. And I'll tell you so recently, I actually hosted Weekend Sunday just a few weeks ago. And that was fun. I had done that many years before, a long time ago. But obviously, I was on Morning Edition. I wasn't going on other shows. So it was similar. It was the same thing. And I ended up doing a book that I saw at the airport. A book on burial rituals.
I listened to that interview.
Yeah. And they knew I would like that. Now, what was it about that story that they thought I would like? I'm not sure. But I jumped at the chance when one of the editors wrote me a note saying, would you like to do this? Because the person who wrote, the gal who wrote the, she's a mortician. She's only 32, been a mortician since she was 22. She's completely committed to this world of burying people in the right way. And it actually was quite touching in some ways. She went around the world finding other kinds of ways people do this and other traditions. And that's sometimes the kind of, if you're going to set up what anyone might think I might do, like to do. I stopped doing novels a long time ago because a good novel, honestly, is very tricky to tell. If it's fiction, you have to read every page and every line. And the only exception I would make for that was if it's like, say, a novel set in, say, Afghanistan, where there's a larger story that you can just start talking about that story.
Yeah.
Or set in a real world environment that you skip the plot. I hate to say it like that, but you skip the plot. If terrorists at the core of the plot, great. Talk about terrorism and how this particular author came up with these characters, you know. But anyway, so mostly didn't do novels, did real life stories. But anything that I don't know that had little miniature stories, little stories in a box, you know, that you can pop it open and there they are, a whole little world. Those are the kinds of interviews I like to do.
Yeah.
As a host.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be doing much of that anymore. Now, I will continue to substitute host, which I like. So, especially the weekend morning shows, because that's a lot of features. So, what better way to occasionally host than a show that does features?
Well, this is actually kind of thinking of your role with Morning Edition. I was thinking about how with radio, like how you've been a part of everyone's morning for so many years. And part of that job is also breaking bad news to people when they first wake up. And I was wondering, how do you see your role as the person who is communicating this information to people in their homes or just waking up? I guess I was just wondering, did you ever have the sense of being like the bearer of bad news and what that responsibility was?
Oh, so many times. I mean, think about the two different Paris attacks, each just as awful as the other. Columbine, I was sub-hosting during that period. I wasn't the host, but it was substitute hosting because that was part of my job at that time. I wasn't there for September 11th, I was actually in Johannesburg, of all places, and got stuck there. I was sent there to do some features in South Africa again. In the course of my hosting from 2004, I was pretty much accidentally – well, Steve and I hosted for the first 10 years where one of us was always on the air. We made a sort of pack. The NPR didn't make us do that. They would have allowed substitutes to come in. But we decided that if we were going to be the people you wake up to every morning, you need to wake up to us every morning. Mm. And especially also being new – you don't know people like, well, who are they? A little less me because I'd been on the show for a long time. But, you know, I'm suddenly there every morning. So you're also talking to people who may not have liked you in the first place. It's not, you know, you can't expect full embrace, you know, from day one. So the idea is also, speak about waking up, especially the morning. It's also true of the afternoon. But people do, including me, get attached to you want to wake up to what you expect. It's very conservative in its own way.
Yeah.
And although it's wonderful to have change, it's probably outvoted by the need to hear that calm voice, especially in the morning, or that voice, I'd like to be calm. So after a while, it wasn't so hard, I think, we came in and had some terrible or stunning news, sometimes just stunning, because I feel, I can only speak for myself in this way, but it's morning for me too. And it's what, you know, I feel the same emotional reactions. So I think naturally your voice changes. You don't want to overdo it. There are things to think about, I suppose, but you're not really thinking about them. That you just develop the skill. You don't want to sound too sad when, you know, but there's transitions you have to make. It's not always all news all the time of the bad thing. So the thing at the top of the show will give way to more fun stuff. And you kind of have to go with that flow. And it gets better and better because you get more and more used to it and more able to kind of own it. But yeah, you know, people wake up. We had slightly other issues, though. A show that runs across the country, I'll say real quickly, runs across the country, you wake up and you've heard the bad news and you've plowed through it. Yeah. Let's just say the Paris attacks. They had started. Sometimes the stuff would start at midnight, just when I got in, and it would really be rolling by 2 o'clock. And we would be doing a lot of the show, but moving to other pre-produced things because you kind of had to. I mean, you didn't have enough information to just keep talking like they do on cable, you know, just keep vamping. But then what would happen, and this was always an interesting, what you call balance, that I was always trying to get into because I was in California, was that after the first 2 hours of the show, which the East Coast hears pretty straightforwardly, maybe, but you guys here wouldn't hear maybe the 5 o'clock hour, that'd be 4 o'clock your time. So it starts, the choices start getting made as if people have been hearing this. Mm. And our job, and it really turned into our job, because as the editors out there would be running around trying to find out new things, trying to bring in new people, you had to, we were the ones, Steve and I, that who would have to, and it's still continuing, the burden of repeating the information, reminding everybody out front that it might be 11 o'clock Eastern and we know everything, but the person waking or tuning in at 8 o'clock in Los Angeles is not going to know what we're talking about, and that you need to recreate this thing much later past your own knowledge base. Yeah. And that was something that, you know, I kind of really know how to do. Helped I was in California. Yeah. Because even if it was 7 o'clock my time, which is, well, I don't know, 7, I'm sorry, 8, 9, 10, 11, almost the end of the show, even East Coast time, they're not running it in the East Coast at that point.
Yeah.
They're not running it in Texas at that point, you know, unless it's all, you know, you go to special coverage.
Yeah.
And so then it's like, guys, you know, don't start making shorthand of this. Let's start it again. Folks waking up today, that was our job.
Yeah.
Because you can't ask the reporters to be worried about that. You can't even ask the producers and editors. So that's the small part where you really are the host. You really are opening the door and welcoming people in to the show at different stages. And and you're the only one that can do that. So that's what we used to do. This sounds like such a minor thing, and I hadn't really thought about it much, but that's exactly what you could do as a host that nobody else could do.
Yeah, I love that. It's like really thinking about the
audience. Think about how shocking it'll be if you're something bad. The Daily Show, you don't think about it too much.
Yeah.
But anything that just happened, even if it's a good thing, which is so rare.
I know.
Good things don't seem to happen overnight.
but when they do, it's wonderful.
Then you get to say, people waking up all over, you know, you don't say California or anything, but, you know, for folks who are just waking up now, this wonderful thing just happened.
And I actually really wanted to ask you about a newer project that you've been working on that has a lot of resonance here in Texas, your work on maternal mortality. Mm-hmm. In the reporting that you've been doing, we know it's a huge issue here in Texas, something that the legislature talked about in 2017, something that they're going to be working on here in the state because we have really high maternal mortality numbers. And I just thought the reporting you've done is so beautiful and also so hard. And what is it like to sort of enter into somebody's life pretty much after the worst thing ever has happened to them, that they've lost a spouse, that they've lost a parent, to something that people from the reporting you did, that nurses in the field didn't even realize that maternal mortality numbers were so high here in the U.S.?
Well, yes, you should say Texas. Texas numbers are sort of off the charts. On the other hand, I'm really I have been really glad to hear that it's generated an enormous amount of talk and concern. And also there is some question about what the numbers really mean. It may have, at least to a small percentage, be a reporting issue. It's being recorded now and it wasn't recorded then.
Yeah.
It might be. But, I mean, there's always elements into why the numbers are there. But it's considered an outlier, not a positive position to be in, actually, when it comes to maternal mortality. California is also considered an outlier in a better way. They actually have been working on this, and their numbers are way down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for years, though. They've been working on it for years. Yes, I'll say something. This is a very interesting transition. When I left Morning Edition, I've done so much that you don't go back, you know. So I wasn't obviously going to go back to general reporting, correspondent reporting. The question was, what am I going to do? We haven't really quite answered that yet. It was clear I would do some host subbing like Linda Wertheimer's been doing and now Melissa too. And that's an obvious path, right? But I proposed last year, I mean, before this announcement, we were checking off what to do, but we never sorted it out. So I was kind of one of those announcements like, she's going to do the world, you know. She's going to do bits of this and bits of that and all platforms. But in fact, what they're very cool about was, you know, what did I want to do? And what I said I wanted to do, I know that NPR is partnered with the Marshall Project, with ProPublica. There's a couple of others, actually, that are these – some of them are older than they would seem, but they've really come into their own in this world of shrinking newspapers. And newspapers, Philadelphia Inquirer and the Baltimore Sun, even small city newspapers, not just the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, but, you know, small, have had investigative reporters who spend a year doing something. Spotlight, that movie,
yeah,
was
definitely
about the Boston Globe. And these are stories right under your noses, stories you might even that people have done, but they take it all the way to where it makes a difference. It has an impact. Impact, the word impact is very big in that world of investigative reporting. I've discovered it. I never knew that.
Yeah.
But I said, is there a project that I can partner with, say, with ProPublica, as it turns out. And ProPublica is quite highly esteemed. They don't have a printing press. They don't have a studio. So they partner with New York Times. They partner with us. And they also have a website. People follow them, no question, but not in the numbers, obviously. They follow a large news organization. They'll partner with Philadelphia Inquirer, too. I mean, they'll partner with anybody, with lots of people. In this case, they were offering to partner with us, and it was exactly the moment. And I had done one story in Afghanistan about just one, but I'd done a lot of stories about women.
Yeah.
And I was I'm not interested per se in having that as a beat, but I'd done a story on a midwife program that had brought up the numbers. Afghanistan, you could look up the CIA. Anybody wants to know what numbers are in the world, look up, just go on the web and look up the CIA. They keep track, and they're considered an excellent source. Afghanistan, maternal mortality and infant mortality, there'd be 10 countries, and I'm sorry to say this, 9 of them were in Africa. There would be countries like Liberia, countries that have been through hell and back, the Congo, countries like that that are so deeply enmeshed in these various wars, you know, Sudan. So, and then there's Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And it was always the bottom or the second from the bottom. And so there's this project in Afghanistan that was able, by engaging with the councils of villages or provinces that were male-dominated, the men in these councils, mostly almost all men, would designate a young woman from their place to send away in a way that no family would ever have sent their daughter to a midwifery school. And so I'll be a little quicker on this, but so they had had great results from the bottom of the barrel.
Wow.
So this story at ProPublica, and I can tell you more in a moment, but the story at ProPublica came to me because they thought NPR's investigations editor, he's wonderful, Bob Little, he said, you know, Renee did that story about, you know, mortality rates in Afghanistan. Maybe she'd be interested in this. And I was, as a good story, but when I jumped into it, and I'll tell you some of the stories, I fell in love with a terrible story.
Mm.
In other words, I have developed quite a passion for this story.
Yeah. And you're meeting people. I mean, I think one of the things that was the most incredible to me is that you were able to, in one of the stories, interview people who had heard earlier reporting about some of the health risks associated with pregnancy, were able to then, because of your reporting, identify that they might have the symptoms and then push back against a healthcare system that is maybe not as, you know, has the information, but is not pushing it out to mothers maybe in the way that should be happening. I mean, was that such an incredible thing to be doing reporting and then see such a concrete impact, that like literally life-saving impact of your work?
Yeah. Well, of course, we'll never be able to prove it was life-saving, but the women we've heard from, and now it's not so many, but to hear from one woman, which we did right after the first big piece came out, and that was the piece you can do on NPR, like a what they call format breaker on All Things Considered, long by our standards. Well, the bigger piece, which I co-reported, written by Nina Martin, my amazing ProPublica partner, but you know, the reporting was ours shared. We literally traveled around together. We were joined at the hip. We were on the same phone calls every interview, except we split up on a couple of interviews. But then I would give her mine, and she would give her hers. So it was an exchange. To have anybody write you and say, I heard your story, I had just given – or not – sometimes they would hear it and they would go to the web and then they would see this story, which, by the way, was so long, it's New Yorker, old-fashioned New Yorker length, that if it had been on the air, it was going to be 53 minutes long.
Wow.
Yeah. If you put it in our system, which counts minutes, you throw it in. In print systems, it's words. Yeah. In our system, it's minutes. Yeah. It pops up at like 53 minutes. So it was like being able to dump all this, and I say dump in the best sense, all this reporting that I would have done to get a 12-minute story that didn't use they used almost none of it, and to flesh out the whole thing. And I do mean, you know, fresh. Yeah, so I know the woman's name because we've been in touch with her quite a bit, Marie McCausland, the first woman. She wrote and she said, she didn't actually write us. We reached out to her because on Reddit, on this particular site called Baby Bumps, she said, you all must read this article that saved my life. Mm. Here it is. And it was us.
Yeah.
And we chatted with her. And yeah, basically her story was she saw this story, this terrible story of a woman, Lauren Bloomstein, and her husband, Larry, and how she, a neonatal intensive care nurse, her husband, a doctor, went into her hospital, and over a span of, she had a baby, she was happy, she was perfectly healthy, she had no problems. I've seen pictures, she was like fit and slender and 32 years old, and 20 hours later she was dead. And it was preeclampsia, and it followed an arc that we're finding is beyond the real hard cases. That's poor women, rural women, African American women die at higher rates, even better off. They don't have to be poor. But that's a large societal problem that you could sort of say is a very complicated problem to solve. But many of the women who die fall in the had great health care, wonderful obstetrician, wonderful nurses. Everything seemed to be going fine. And what seems to happen is because it is still rare, but three times more likely in America to die than Europe, any place in Europe, Britain, in the Scandinavian countries, it's up to eight times more likely. Canada, three times more likely. Women die here in greater numbers, ratio, in greater percentages. And the numbers are low, but there's sort of a tip of the iceberg because there's about 65, the CDC says 65,000 women who almost die. And we're talking what's called severe morbidity, severe near death, meaning they come away damaged. Mm. And that's a lot in a year.
Yeah.
And so I was going to say, Maria said, anyway, she saw the article. She was coming down with something called preeclampsia, headache, high blood pressure, swelling. Mm-hmm. But she had a difficult, nothing to do with this, had a difficult for other reasons, pregnancy and birth. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I don't want to face what's wrong with me. And nobody was paying attention to her. And she read the article 3 days later and said, oh my gosh, this is really real. So she went to the emergency room. The doctor waved her away, the emergency room doctor. He wasn't an obstetrician. No, it's fine. You're fine. There was even a lab test that suggested is a test for preeclampsia. No, it's on the edge. You'll be fine. Go home. And she believes if she had just gone home, it would have gotten too far out of control. And that's why women tend to die. I was going to say the arc is it's not recognized. It's not expected. The medical system, this is a generalization, is not prepared for it. Things like hemorrhages, which should be caught all the time. Women die. One of the top reasons for death is hemorrhages. Nobody should die of that. In Britain, one woman a year in the last two women in 2 years, the last records they had, died of preeclampsia. That's an insanely low number. Basically, no one dies of it there. Women die of it here by the scores. Over years, it's thousands of women.
Yeah.
So I'll say one thing about doing this, though. It's so opposite of Morning Edition, where I had to be up on everything. I'm still up on everything. I'm like everybody else. I'm still sit up in the middle of the night reading my, you know, retweets and different ways of the New York Times. I mean, I'm still doing what I always did. But I don't bring it to this kind of reporting. And yeah. What is even before Morning Edition. So Morning Edition is in the high. Glad to meet you. See you later. Even in the best sense. I've had some beautiful, amazing, touching conversations, memorable. But you never, ever see people again, basically. You're not on a beat. You rarely interview the same real person twice. You know, experts, yes, maybe. But when I was really reporting, one of the things I always noted when people ask about what it meant to do general reporting was I would get to know people for a day. I would tell their story, whatever the story was, often at the point of great tragedy. Sometimes happiness, but always at a very seminal point in their life because otherwise they wouldn't be a story. So, and then we would walk away. And I used to say, I still would say that kind of reporting, it's almost like you're for a moment, you're a psychologist or you're somebody they've come to, if you do it right, for some kind of solace or some kind of way to tell their story. And then you don't have the burden of seeing, and I didn't mean it in a bad way, but just you don't have to carry it emotionally with you.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. These stories, we have come to know these people. I mean, the women who have written us to say or been in touch say that we saved their life. There's other women who said it made all the difference in the world to me to hear that. There's other women who said, I didn't know you could die of that. Mostly people don't know women die. In Texas, I think they do because it's become a big story.
Definitely.
But around the country, believe me, when I started this, literally people would draw a blank. Mm. Women die of it must be the poor woman those poor women who don't get any prenatal care. And it's not that at all. We're pretty good with prenatal care in this country.
Yeah.
A lot of these deaths are in the birth or postpartum when women just go, it's like this, hi, bye, let me tell you all about how to take care of the baby. You'll be okay.
Yeah, and then they send them on their way.
You know, it'll hurt.
Yeah.
There'll be things, but don't bother us.
Yeah.
And that's not meant in any way. It's just how it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, hoping, talk about an impact, the impact we would hope for, Nina and I, would be to really have an impact on how postpartum, like, information is given out and how women are treated. They should be seen all the time. Babies seen in the first week. You know, they should have pediatricians saying to the mother, how do you feel? They don't have to treat them.
Yeah.
They just have to pay attention, stuff like that. So it's kind of a subtle story, but I've developed these relationships with the doctors, with the nurses, with Larry Bloomstein, who's so sweet. He's remarried, and his new wife is now. It was such a tragedy. It was such a terrifying story for him to tell. And but they're having a baby in December.
Renee, thank you so much for coming into the studio today at KWBU and talking about both your work on Morning Edition, but also the incredible and impactful reporting that you're doing now on maternal mortality and other stories that you're working on.
Thank you, Becky. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to an exclusive interview with Renee Montaigne, special correspondent and former host of NPR's Morning Edition. Renee visited Waco for KWBU President's Circle and Cornerstone Society events. Hosting the conversation was Becky Fogel, newscast host and producer for Texas Standard and former reporter for KWBU. This special edition of the Central Texas Leadership Series was recorded October 26, 2017 in the KWBU studio. This and past episodes of the Central Texas Leadership Series can be found online under the Programs tab at kwbu.org.